Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talked. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. And what a hot summer episode we have for your sweaty ears. We're going to be featuring some great literature-related music. We're going to be talking about live literary events that are really exciting. And we've got the Booker Prize long-listed author, Ruth Ozeki, here to talk about her latest novel. It's jam-packed. We really hope you're going to enjoy it as much as we have enjoyed putting it together. And we're going to start the podcast by introducing you to Ruth Ozeki. Now, if you haven't read Ruth Ozeki's work, you really, really do need to check it out. We caught up with her at Looking Glass Books in Edinburgh. She was talking about her book, A Tale for the Time Being, which is just magnificent. Just one of those books you can't put down and is really engaging and thoughtful and provoking. Ruth was invited to Edinburgh as part of Independent Booksellers Week. Here in Scotland, we have tons of great independent bookshops, no matter where you are in the country. In fact, we have Booktown, our own Booktown in Scotland's Wigtown. Plenty of opportunities for you to go out and find local bookshops and to support them by going to events, buying books, or just hanging out and having a cup of coffee. Thanks to Looking Glass Books and, of course, the independent Scottish publisher Canongate Books for setting up this fantastic event and letting us do an interview with the super lovely Ruth Ozeki. Ladies and gentlemen, here she is.
My name is Ruth Ozeki, and my latest book is A Tale for the Time Being. Hi. My name is Now, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I'll tell you. A time being is someone who lives in time, and that means you and me and every one of us who is, or was, or ever will be. As for me, right now, I'm sitting in a French maid cafe in Akiba Electricity Town, listening to a sad chanson that's playing sometime in your past, which is also my present, writing this and wondering about you somewhere in my future. And if you're reading this, then maybe by now you're wondering about me too. You wonder about me. I wonder about you.
For the benefit of our listeners who haven't had a chance to read it, just set up a little bit about what the book's about.
It is kind of a sprawling book, but at its heart, I think it's a book about the relationship between a writer and a reader. In this case, the reader is a 16-year-old Japanese schoolgirl named Nao Yasutani, and she's writing a diary. And in her diary, I should also mention that she's quite troubled. She's being bullied at school, and she's decided that she's going to commit suicide. But before she does, in her diary, she is going to do one last kind of redemptive act, which is to tell the life story of her 104-year-old great-grandmother, who's a Zen Buddhist nun. And she's writing this kind of for posterity, but she is intending to kind of cast her diary out into the world, where she is confident that it will be found and read by a reader. Of course, she doesn't know exactly who that reader is when she starts, but indeed, the diary does wash up on the shores of a remote island in British Columbia, where it is discovered by a novelist named Ruth. Coincidentally enough, Ruth and I share a lot in common.
And this was something that was surprising to me, because you talk about this idea of the writer and the reader. Diary was written in roughly 2006, I guess. The diary was found washed up in Canada around 2011. You didn't know who the reader was when you started writing the book, which actually, it seems so that the book was so well put together, so natural and deceptively simple almost. You have a chapter where it's a bit of the diary, which is totally captivating, and then you have the reader of the diary kind of slowly eking out that possible suicide. Mm-hmm. You know, really brilliantly done. But you didn't know any of this at the time when you started writing, which is amazing. It took you full drafts before you even found who the actual reader was, which was kind of yourself.
Kind of me. That's right. Yeah. No, it did. I started writing it at the end of 2006, and I didn't know who. I knew that there was going to be a reader for the diary, but I didn't know who it was. And so I think I went through four or five different readers, kind of auditioning them, you know, and letting them kind of, you know, enter the narrative. And you know, I'd write like 50 pages or 100 pages, and then suddenly I realized that the fictional world just was going flat, and so I'd bring in the next reader and try that out, and that wouldn't work. And And then, and that continued like that until 2011 when I'd actually finished a draft. It wasn't a very good draft, but I had finished a draft. And then the Japanese earthquake, you know, the 2011 Tohoku earthquake hit, followed by the tsunami and followed by the meltdown at Fukushima. I found that just absolutely devastating. I spent weeks, months watching the footage, you know, of the wave just demolishing these towns. And in any case, you know, in the aftermath of that, I realized that the book that I had written was now irrelevant. You know, it you can't have, you know, an event of that magnitude. It changes everything. Japan was a different country. The world was different. You can't write a book without somehow reflecting that. So, you know, I was just about to submit the book to my editor, but I withdrew it. For the fourth or fifth time, I basically unzipped the narrative, threw half of it away, and that's when I, you know, stepped in myself and decided to kind of become a semi-fictional character, you know, in the book as this character of Ruth, who, as you say, you know, finds the book washed up on the shore and then proceeds to, you know, and assumes that it's debris from the tsunami, and then becomes engrossed in trying to understand the fate of this girl who may or may not have perished in the tsunami.
And exactly as the reader myself was, right? Or just yes. Totally addicted. As soon as, and in the way it begins is brilliant, and it works really, really well. Did you have the pacing of the diary entry set up like that as you were slotting in your own, the trial readers? Or did you just write the entire diary? Because it's so brilliantly paced where, like, when one entry ends, when we stop reading one entry to go to Ruth's life, you're like, oh, yeah, why did you do that? Just read the thing. And, of course, somebody in the book mentioned, why don't you just read the whole thing at once? No.
Yeah.
We're gonna tease it out. That's right.
You know, and since the book so much is so much about time and about the pacing of the reading and all of that. I mean, you know, Ruth is, you know, at one point in the diary, you know, in the book, Ruth decides that she is going to read the diary at the same rate at which it was written, or at least the rate at which she thinks it might have been written, you know. And so there's this whole kind of playing around with, you know, with how, you know, styles of reading, pace, you know, the pace of reading, all of that kind of thing. It, you know, I love your question because it's so clearly the question of a writer, you know. Only a writer would think to ask a question like that. The idea, Now's diary comes in little chunks. Yes, the various readers did, in fact, you know, sort of slot in there and respond to those chunks in different ways. Of course, the thing, though, is that, you know, every time a reader reads a work, the reader changes the work. So Now's story changed, too, depending on who was reading it. Okay, so, you know, as I said, I you know, had about, at various points, you know, four or five different readers in that role, and each reader changed the outcome of her story slightly. And I think that's very reflective of what actually happens, you know, in that relationship between a writer and a reader. Every reader reads a different book.
Yeah. And it's not always so tangible as you obviously make it as you're editing some things, because if it's a 60-year-old man reading it, then Now is going to have a different voice that's going to slightly more affect that 60-year-old man. And I love the way that Now's diary started to affect Ruth's mentality. You know, talking about that bigger theme of time, I mean, I loved how incredibly current it felt because of, I guess, your rewriting of post-tsunami, which made everything feel very present and also kind of reminded us all how we've sort of forgotten about this really terrible thing that happened, and it went through the news cycle, which, again, Ruth mentions, and this part of it, too, both the impermanence of the words we read and the things we pay attention to and the permanence of them are oddly at odds. And I guess maybe that's where great-grandmother character comes in, because it's both. Time is both. It's constant and eternal and totally gone in a second.
Exactly. And I think so much of the book is playing with exactly those kinds of things, you know, like, what is the scale of time? You know, how do we measure it? How do we measure out our days? You know, one of the fun things in the book, I think, is the references to the 13th century Zen master Dogen Zenji, who has this, you know, who in one of his essays talks about how, let me see if I can get this right, how a day is 24 hours, you know, what we think of as a day, is broken up into a certain number of moments, right? Over 6 billion moments in a day. And how in the snap of a finger, is 64 moments, right? And his point is that each one of those moments is an opportunity to turn your life around, to do something beneficial for the world and for, you know, for yourself, to exert your will. And there's something very interesting about, you know, taking time as we normally perceive it and expanding it like that, you know, and there's something very generous and lovely about that. So, you know, the whole book is kind of playing with, yeah, with things like that.
And when, how hard was it to write the now as in terms of a current event? It's quite difficult to assess something, look at it, and then get it onto a piece of paper as it's sort of happening, even quickly.
Well, you know, I mean, the any references to the tsunami and to the earthquake are sort of filtered through the mind of the character Ruth. You know, the girl's diary was written prior to the tsunami, and so then, you know, but Ruth's reaction to the diary, you know, has to encompass her reaction to the tsunami and to the earthquake and to the meltdown at Fukushima, and so in a way, you know, it was a way for me to really come to grips with, or not that one can come to grips with it, but to at least, you know, sort of to really investigate my own really upset feelings about, you know, what was happening in Japan, and precisely what you mentioned earlier, you know, that for 2 weeks, you know, we were inundated with these images of tsunami footage from Japan. And then I think it was the hurricane in Joplin came along and knocked it off the front page, and then an uprising. In any case, you know, after 2 weeks, it was basically over as far as the news cycle is concerned. But in reality, of course, that's not the case. You know, I mean, people are still continuing to suffer and will always continue to suffer as a result of that. And it's something about the ephemeral nature of our, you know, news cycle that I really wanted to talk about in the book as well.
And I think one thing that it does really well, because we know now who's in Japan and her family, and we care about her, we understand what human empathy is, mm-hmm, for a person. And then all of a sudden, this tsunami begins to affect the reader's mentality of what it means. It's so suddenly not so distant. Yeah. It's not across the world. Yeah. It's happening to us. And then this ties in to, you know, what empathy is and the point of art and fiction, which I guess in some ways is about bullying and the bullying that now suffers from, and the bullying that, and the fear of these things, and then ties back into like the grandiose notions of America versus, mm-hmm, and the bullying of the war that was happening, yes, at the time, yes, of that writing.
It's exactly what I was working with. I was working with this idea that we, you know, that we live in a bully culture, and I wanted to really look at that culture and sort of take that notion of bullying and turn it, look at it from different angles. You know, really look at the way that bullying is not something that children make up. You know, bullying is something that has its roots in a larger cultural context, you know, be it the, you know, the presidency or the military, or, you know, it's not an isolated incident that children just do to each other. You know, this is something that, you know, they learn this from somewhere. And so that was certainly a you know, a very key theme in the book.
Was it hard to get into the head of a 16-year-old now?
No. She got into my head. I don't know how else to put it. You know, it was not hard. She was there. You know, I don't really have any recollection of constructing her as a character. She just kind of was there. The best characters come to me that way. And, you know, now I've been living with her for a long time. And so she feels like a fully fledged person to me. You know, very often she would do things or say things that surprised me. But that's always the case for good characters. They lead you in directions that you can't really plan for. At least this is my experience of writing. Every writer is different. You know, some people write very differently than this, and you know, that's their way of doing it.
Ruth Ozeki, everybody go check out her book, A Tale for the Time Being. She's also got other fantastic novels out there. You can find out all about her on her website, ruthozeki.com. Thanks again to her. Ruth Ozeki was in Edinburgh for Independent Booksellers Week. She was on a bit of a nationwide tour. We also caught up with a band, actually, recently, who was also on a bit of a UK tour, and they were only playing gigs in bookshops. It's a really special model, and we talked to the band themselves a little bit later on in the podcast, but we wanted to share this track with you because it was inspired by Ruth Ozeki's A Tale for the Time Being. This is The Bookshop Band.
Down is a band, up is down. Tell me, are you going?
Bookshop Band, everybody. Absolutely lovely, lovely music, and incredibly cool to have people like getting inspired by books and making songs about them, and then playing these books, playing these songs in your local bookshop. We're going to be hearing more from them in a little bit. But one thing I think that the Bookshop Band does really well is it engages people, and it makes books and literary and reading, it just brings that whole kind of community together in a really, really fun and exciting way. And that's something that our friend Todd Zuniga does with his event, The Literary Death Match, which sounds obviously a bit threatening, but actually, if you've been to any of these events, they've happened throughout Scotland for the past few years, and he goes all over the world with them, and they're making a TV show out of the Literary Death Match. It's actually just really, really good literary fun. It's a bit of a joke. It's a bit serious. They're great, great nights. And we wanted to sit down with Todd before his event at Unbound at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, just to give you a little taste of what Literary Deathmatch is really all about. So here he is, Mr. Todd Zuniga.
I'm Adrian Todd Zuniga, and I'm the creator and host of Literary Deathmatch. For the three people that don't know, it is a live event which features four writers reading their own work for 7 minutes or less, and then we have three judges who judge them on the categories of literary merit, performance, and intangibles, and then they pick a winner after making some wonderful, hilarious commentary, but never mean-spirited, not to Simon Cowell, if you guys know that reference. They pick a winner from each round, and then those two compete in the Literary Deathmatch finale, which is sort of like a literary-skewed game that will change your life. Like, pin the mustache on Hemingway, or last night we played Play Your Cards Right with literary figures on the card as opposed to just kings and queens and all that.
It can get weird, those final bits, right?
It can get very weird. Just in Boston, we had our 7-year anniversary show. We had people throwing cupcakes at the face, a poster of George Saunders, which is sort of one of our most celebrated writers in America right now. So the person who got their icing color closest to his mouth, the center of his mouth, won Literary Deathmatch. And Andre Debuse III, who wrote the book Sand and Fog, House of Sand and Fog, became a major motion picture, as they call it. He was good. I think he pitched in high school. So that's how we decided that one, which is always fun. The idea being the celebration of the cupcakes. We're throwing it at a poster of a writer's face that we love. So it's sort of like ironic, like, well, he didn't do the show, so we have this privilege, but at the same time, we adore this guy. So yeah, it's pretty fun.
And what I like about it is exactly that last thing, because when you hear about Literary Deathmatch, you think two things. One, that it's going to be a deathmatch, that it's going to be highly competitive, which it is. The artists who are reading are talented. They're top-notch, right? But it's not mean-spirited. It's not like a knockout round. And then you have this last segment where instead of doing two more final readings between the remaining contestants, they do something really stupid. Yeah. Was that conscious? Did you try it another way, or did you just go in from the very beginning thinking, we can't have 8 readings in a row, we're going to have to do something funny?
My whole goal of the show is to undermine any competitive aspect, because, you know, ultimately, as competitive as people will become in the finals, they're sort of, you know, the nature of the show and the way I host is very much about just have fun. Like, let's expose these people to your work. Let's, you know, get the word out about literature, get everybody electrified around it. And then the finale, it was sort of like, I didn't want to put anybody in an embarrassing position. We're very careful not to make the finales embarrassing, but we want people to do silly things like throwing cupcakes or unscrambling writers' names or being blindfolded and pinning William Faulkner's mustache on Hemingway's face. Like, it's like all illusions and sort of ridiculous, but it's just fun. And like I said, undermining the competitive aspect is really important, because we don't want anybody to have hurt feelings. I'm my mother's son. Like, I want everybody in the room to feel good, the writers, the judges, the audience. I love the lunacy too, and the absurdity of the finale. It leaves everybody with a really good, warm feeling, and just sort of like, I can't believe what I just saw. Yeah. You know, and that's really important, I think.
And writers are incredibly competitive often, you know, and it does have that thing. So you take that kind of element of, like, actually, it's just a big joke, right? But it isn't a joke, because the writing's quite serious. And how did it end up getting such an international reputation? Because where did it start out again?
It started in New York in March of 2006, and then we moved to San Francisco, I think Chicago, and then Beijing, which is the thing about it being international, and what's so cool about it, and being here in Edinburgh is like further proof of that, is they're the great best-selling writers, or the great, like, award-winning writers, but every city has these just champions of writing that are so good and so unique and so cool and doing things that are just beyond what anybody else anywhere is doing. I mean, Finland, the events are all in Finnish, but hearing the translated stories and reading those and finding out what these people are reading, because we do the event. I host in English. Everybody else does it in Finnish. I have no idea what's going on until the end. But, you know, there's a really unique literary style there, and it's really cool. And Edinburgh has its own thing, and London and San Francisco and New York, and everybody has such a different style. And to be able to bring out these people and make stars of them and put them on the same stage as the other great writers that we've had do it, it's just cool. And the judges, and finding funny people in different cities, and finding a ballerina from Montreal to judge one time, we had that. And in Pittsburgh, we had a ballerina. It was just like bringing personalities together and making it sort of meaningless and meaningful, exposing the audience to new things, exposing me to new people. You know, yeah. It's all very selfish, really. I just want to hang out with ballerinas and chefs and cool writers.
And of course, you have this whole idea of the intangibles, which means basically nothing.
Right. Yeah. It's funny that when I'm prepping the judges, there's a literary merit performance and intangibles judge. And when I turn to the intangibles judge, I say, you get to say pretty much whatever you want about anything you want. You don't even have to speak as if you were in the room during the reading. And I say the audience prefers if you mention the reader once or twice, but you really don't have to. And I've seen some great things happen out of that. And one guy just talked about the Tony Awards and who was going to win the Tony Awards in response to each reader. And he like subtly tied it back into the readings, but it was so funny because the subtlety made it so magic.
You put together a pilot for the TV.
Yeah, we raised $12,000 on Kickstarter in October, and then we realized that was about half of what we needed to create a TV show, so that was really fun, trying to independently fund another $12,000. But yeah, we now have a TV reel that we're pitching, and it featured Michael C. Hall from Dexter, and Moby, the musician, and Jonathan Lethem, and Susan Orlean, and Tig Notaro, who's a comedian that you should immediately download her album off iTunes. And it was such a cool show, and we did it in a boxing ring, 450 people, like lights, camera, action. Like it was a production. I mean, we usually just walk up into a city, try to throw enough together to make it work, and to do a TV show, it was amazing. So we're going to be pitching that in Cannes and at the beginning of April, and then in America right after that, and just going hog wild and getting on TV. But I think, you know, I really think if we can pull off a TV show, it's going to change the direction of books for a little while at least, because the idea of our thing is always to make books pop culture, to get them back into the pop culture conversation alongside Mad Men or Sherlock or Downton Abbey and things like that, and like to have people talking about books in the same way they talk about films and movies in their email. Instead of complaining about your email, you can talk about the latest novel by Neil Gaiman. So if we can pull that off, it would be a really, really special, amazing thing. And it would explode the live show and get those writers that are underexposed even more exposure as well. So that's my grand master plan. Support it.
Oh, you're on your way to Milan as well, and they want to talk to you about the future of the book and kind of Literary Death Master's involvement in that. Is this what you're going to say? Is this the kind of pitch? Is like making literature exciting on the stage will affect the future of publishing?
Yeah, I really think it's about accessibility, because if there's a big film that comes out, you see the star interviewed and you then have a connection to the star. And the thing about books is if you buy a book and you love a book, you basically are confined to that author image. I mean, nowadays you can Google things and find them. But the idea of seeing them on the stage the way we do it and have it all sexy and cool and like just celebratory, I think that's really important for books. And I don't think enough people do that. It's almost like we've done it for so long by doing it 7 years, it's sort of become our thing to do it that way. But I think it's really important for book people to understand that having great video and great things to promote writers from like a live event that's well shot and really special and has a certain feel to it is really important. And one of our things in the future is we want to try to find publishers to sponsor just us getting a camera in the room and then giving that content to their ebook or whatever there is to put out there, so that it's, you know, it's the great lighting and the dynamic feel to help promote things and in a proper way, instead of just a dusty old bookstore reading at, you know, some bookstore that doesn't look that cool, you know, like one camera, boring shot. But you know, that's one thing. But I think books have a huge future. I'm just, there's going to be a renaissance. I hope we're at the front of it, because that means we get paid more money than we do right now, which isn't very much. But you know, mostly I have some really big ideas about how to do it, and we can't do it yet because of fiscal reasons. But yeah, hopefully it all works out. We can explode the whole literary scene and really, I don't know, just work together with every possible person who cares about literature just to elevate it to a really awesome degree.
Yeah, I think you can get kind of stuck bemoaning the state of the industry and forgetting that actually if you just have fun and have a good time, which is why a lot of people got into it to begin with, you can actually have a career and a revitalization of the industry.
Yeah.
Speaking of books, maybe a great thing to do is top five books from literary deathmatch performers.
Yeah, the first one that comes to mind would be Edgar Carret's Suddenly a Knock on the Door. That's probably one of the greatest books ever. Amelia Gray, who lives about 2.5 blocks from me, she wrote a book called Threats that was just nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award. She's shortlisted. I'm so excited for her. Three other people. Jeffrey Eugenides, he was a judge for us. I mean, obviously, The Virgin Suicides is well known because of the film, but Middlesex is just such... Talking about eye-opening in terms of transgender, that's an incredible book. There's a bit of a spoiler alert in what I just said, but I think people might know by now. Oh, Amanda Filippaki wrote a book called Nude Men, which is, I think, out of print, but you can find it. That's one of the great books that I've ever read. I love that book so deeply. She's a great, great writer out of New York. Here's what I wish, that Joshua Ferris, who wrote The Unnamed, or Marilyn Robinson, who we're now trying to get, who wrote Housekeeping, will do the show. That Housekeeping is the perfect book, and to have her judge literary merit would be one of the hugest honors in the world. And so I'm going to say, you know what, I'm just going to look to the future. By the time this runs, we'll have had Marilyn Robinson confirm that she's going to judge at Iowa City. So Housekeeping, which every single person should read, especially women, I think it's like the most important feminist novel that I don't even know if it's a feminist book, but it just makes me think women are like 15 times more awesome than I already do, and I love them.
Todd Zuniga, everybody. LiteraryDeathmatch.com is the website. Check it out. Loads of great stuff on there. And also you can keep tabs on where Todd's going to be next. I can almost guarantee there will be a literary deathmatch near you somewhere soon. And of course, Todd and the Literary Deathmatch is going to be at Jura Unbound as part of the Edinburgh International Book Festival. That's going to be on the 23rd of August at 9 p.m. It's totally free. So go down to the Spiegel Tent in Charlotte Square and discover madcap literary excitement. And I've been told that Mr. Neil Gaiman might be there. I've never heard of him, but apparently he's quite a big deal. And speaking of Jura Unbound and the whole Spiegel Tent environment, the Bookshop Band are also going to be playing at Jura Unbound on the 20th of August. That's also at 9 o'clock. It's also free. And we wanted to close the podcast with a little conversation from them to give you a little bit of an idea of exactly what they do. They read a lot of books, these guys, and then they make songs about them. Here they are in their glory. Book Talk's absolute favorite band. Ladies and gentlemen, the Bookshop Band.
Ben, please.
Poppy Pitt and Beth Porter.
We are basically a bunch of customers of a little independent bookshop in Bath called Mr. B's Emporium of Reading Delights.
There's a story waiting inside, behind the door as it opens wide, and I wander in, hoping to find something.
And the owner of that shop wanted to do something a bit kind of different for their author evenings and have a bit of relevant music at the start. And so we're three songwriters, and they asked us whether we'd, you know, do some music. But because we're songwriters, we thought, actually, no, we'll take it as a challenge and write some music for the evenings. We actually started off, the themes were based on different countries to start off. So we started off doing folk tales, writing songs inspired by folk tales for like the first five author events. And then when we got to the second season, the theme was actually Adultery Night. And the book was The Paris Wife by Paula McLean. And we thought, you know, we don't really know anything about that. How can we write a song about adultery? So we actually turned to the book instead and wrote a couple of songs inspired by Paula McLean's book. And the process was just so nice, and the author's response was great, and the audience loved it, and the bookshop loved it, and we really enjoyed it, and it was the most relevant thing we could possibly do. So we did it for the next night and the next author night, and then just carried on and just writing songs about books.
Have you ever worried that the author would be disappointed, or are you like, maybe this is not the right way to...
I think we worry every time, because it's a really nerve-wracking process, because we generally finish the songs like the day before, or maybe on the day of the gig, take them to the bookshop. The authors sat there, the publishers sat there, everyone who loves the book sat there, and we have to play our brand new song to them. So it's terrifying, but actually we've been really lucky and everyone's always had a really lovely response. So fingers crossed, that'll stay that way.
So this was just a kind of almost a lark, it sounds like. You're playing in the bookshop there in Bath, and then you're on tour. You're here in Looking Glass Books in Edinburgh. You're going all over the place, but you're just playing bookshops.
Yeah, we're pretty much just playing bookshops or venues. If the bookshop's too small, then something that's nearby that we think we can fit in and we can fit the right amount of people in. But a lot of the bookshops are tiny and we just, you know, squeeze ourselves in.
Basically, it takes you to really interesting spots, because wherever there is an independent bookstore, a place that can support that is by nature going to be an interesting place with quite a lot going on. So we've ended up in some really nice places.
So where else have you been? Are there bookshops that you remember?
Bigger today. It's got a brilliant bookshop.
But we've also this year we've also been to Paris, and we've been to Shakespeare and Co. And we did 10 days in Ireland as well, which was really nice. And last year when we first sort of ventured out of our bookshop, we just went to all the sort of local bookshops sort of within driving distance of our home. So this year it was like, let's get as far away as we can and see how far we can take it.
It's such a great idea. It's such a great novel idea. That was a pun, huh? Do you get that a lot?
Some people don't realize that they're saying it. They kind of say it and don't realize their own joke.
Tell us a little bit about the song that you guys are gonna share with our audience now.
Next track is it's called The Paris Wife, and it's the first book we wrote a song on, inspired by a book called The Paris Wife by Paula McLean, and it's about Ernest Hemingway and his first wife, and it's written from her perspective, and so you follow their move to Paris and his sort of rise in his literary career and her fall away from him. It's quite a moody song, but you'll hear it, so yeah.
A lot of your songs are probably moody.
Done one on Alice in Wonderland, and that's a really quite a quirky one.
And also one based on a dictionary as well, yeah. So that kind of came out a bit funny.
What dictionary? Urban Slang Dictionary?
No, it was Mark Forsyth's The Horologicon. So it's kind of looking at old English words and kind of taking you through the day in the life of what you, maybe someone going to an office, waking up and doing their whole day, but using a load of old words in the, old English words. And it's hilarious. It's great.
Sounds great. If people like your music and like the sound of what you're doing, they can find more of it where, and they can purchase the CD or e-download or something like that.
Yeah, we've got a website, which is thebookshopband.co.uk, and we're on Twitter and Facebook and all those kind of things. And we've got 4 albums released, which are available, which we did in our first year, and we're just recording our second 4 lot of albums from writing for what we've done for this year. So we'll have 8 albums quite soon. So lots to choose from.
that's a lot of albums. How long are the albums?
8 to 10 tracks each.
New music?
Yeah, new music. And it's deadlines. It's just the bookshop phones us up and says, right, we've got this author coming in next week and here's the book, and we go and do 2 songs and then we play them, and then they give us another book, and then we've got another 2 songs, and after like 5 events, that's an album's worth of songs, and then there's another one, and it just keeps coming. And yeah, we have to read, we've written about 90 songs in 2 years now.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is The Paris Wife by the Bookshop Band.
We fell in love and married, moved to Paris. You'd be a writer and I'd be your everlasting love. Accordions and halls were to be our background score. I'd cut my hair and you'd grow yours. We'd be the same guy, you'd say, just like the same guy, you'd say. Then each day you'd disappear into your fierce world of words. My Ernest, a mere young Miss Hemingway. My Ernest, a mere young Miss Hemingway. Red-headed, wedded, waiting, steady and straight. You are the best parts of me, he'd say. But he was like an island where the weather always changed, and I'm a small boat tethered to his fate. But I made the rope and tied the knot around the stake, and I threw the anchor overboard on our wedding day. And he was like an island where the weather always changed, and I'm a small boat tethered to his fate. But I made the rope and tied the knot around the stake, and I threw the anchor overboard on our wedding day. You'd be a writer and I would be your everlasting love. You'd be a writer as you grew away. And as you grew away. And the words were the waves that war against the stake that I place. And by the end I was loosening the knot. I'd let my boat slip aside into still waters away from your tide that continued to roll across the sea. I played my part and so had she.
Thanks to the Bookshop Band, man. They are really lovely guys. Don't forget, go see them live at Jura Unbound at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. They will be totally rocking the Spiegel tent. That's on the 20th of August at 9 p.m. Also, don't forget, there's going to be the Literary Death Match with the great Todd Zuniga. Thanks to him for sitting down and making time to talk to us. You can go to see Literary Death Match on the 23rd of August at 9 p.m. for free. And also, thanks to Ruth Ozeki. Remember her book, her latest book, the Booker Prize Longlisted, A Tale for the Time Being, is excellent, and it is at fine independent bookshops everywhere. She's great. Go and support your local bookshop now. Don't forget, there's loads more podcasts where this came from. You can check us out on the Scottish Book Trust website under podcasts. Check out Book Talk or subscribe to us on iTunes. Loads of ways to get great wordy material into your ears without having to lift a finger. It's super easy. You can follow us on Twitter at ScottishBKTrust or like us on Facebook. Our website is www.scottishbooktrust.com. We'll be back with you very, very soon with more hot literary action through this sweltering summer. Bye for now. Book Talk is produced by Colin Fraser with music from Ragland.